Right, show 100 of Read On. How is it down in London?
Probably not as wet and rainy as it is in Glasgow.
We get good days some days. So after the theme tune and the lovely Ashley, your first line is, hello and welcome to Read On. I'm Red Sail, and coming up this week.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up this week...
And what is coming up this week?
Well, there's so much to choose from. We've interviewed authors who've written about crime, politics, current affairs, mountaineering, canoeing.
Oh, the mountaineering gives me a thought, because Read On has existed long before we were both involved in it. It was a magazine for RNIB Talking Book Users for a while. Then I took over and it was on radio for, I think, about a year and a half, and then you joined in. But I think we should go pre-Red Sail and start off with the first time we ever met, which was at the Wigtown Book Festival in 2015.
When we were younger, more beautiful people.
And we talked about your book, The Blind Man of Hoy.
It's the story of how I went from middle-aged, overweight house husband to becoming the first blind person to climb the Old Man of Hoy, which is Europe's tallest sea stack.
Now, you started losing your sight at 19. How did you spot the signs?
I was diagnosed when I was 19. I had noticed in my mid-teens that I didn't see as well in the dark as other people, but I just put that down to also being short-sighted. But I was on holiday in Greece with my parents, and it was broad daylight, and I walked into a lamppost. And once I'd convinced them that I wasn't drunk or stoned, they took me off to the local hospital in Sussex, and I was diagnosed as having retinitis pigmentosa. And there was no history of it in the family. It just sort of seemed to come completely out of the blue, which was a bit of a shock. The RNIB put me in touch with a chap who popped up once and saw me at university. And he had retinitis pigmentosa. And we chatted a bit, but to be perfectly honest, I was 19. I didn't want to accept my diagnosis, and it had come as such a shock. The consultant, I think, was embarrassed because there wasn't a cure. He couldn't offer a 19-year-old boy hope that there would be a cure. It was just bad news. And I think he was embarrassed. I didn't want to hear the diagnosis. And really, I just shut down for the best part of 10 years, to be honest.
I've heard you talk about being a small boy surrounded by canyons of books in a library. How did your diagnosis affect your reading?
I was an English undergraduate when I found out that I was losing my sight. So, you know, reading was the core of what I did. And it was both study and enjoyment and, you know, escapism. And I was lucky that until about 35, I could still read a book with strong light and reading glasses. But when that started going, I just got very depressed. Partly I solved it by starting to write myself. So in some ways it freed that genie from the bottle. But as any writer will tell you, you can't write unless you read. You have to read other people's work. And talking books has been a lifeline for me. My life would not be half as pleasurable without talking books. And there's a wonderful library of pretty much anything you could want to read. And the fact that you can also request that books are recorded is just terrific. So I'm going to sound a little bit like a heavy drinker here. You know, I'm on two books a week. And if there was just more time in my life, I would be on more. Being able to sort of cart my daisy machine around the house and do the cooking, do the ironing, feed the cat whilst listening to a daisy is just perfect. So thank you, RNIB, for the talking books.
What sort of books do you listen to?
It's a bit of anything and everything. I'm addicted to crime fiction. I write crime fiction myself. So, and I love the golden age of crime books. So Marjorie Allingham, Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie. Equally, I love the Shardlake books, which, you know, have been written more recently. But I listen to mountaineering books. There's a fine selection of Chris Bonington books to listen to. I listen to biographies. All those books that I should have read at university and never did because I spent too much time having fun. So, I've gone back and filled in the holes in the sort of, Dickens and Jane Austen that I only ever read criticism books about. But there's just such a wide range. And every so often, I don't know whether I'm it's only me, but every so often either I order something that I must have mistaken for something else, or there's a glitch and I'll just get something totally and utterly out of the blue. And I'll be listening to, the biography of some poor woman who grew up in the in the rough end of Glasgow and had some awful wasting disease, and I'll think, I would never have picked that up. And suddenly I would just find that I'm loving it and I've had an insight into somebody else's life that I would never have had otherwise. So there's always something there. I so look forward to those little CD packages coming through my letterbox.
But for someone who uses the library so much, you recognise voices and think, oh, well, I like him or I like her, and when the book starts?
It's very strange. I mean, like a lot of people, I went straight for the Sherlock Holmes stories. And they can be a bit hit and miss, the recordings. Peter Cushing did, I think, the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. And I actually had to speed up the Daisy machine because otherwise he was going to send me to sleep. But every so often you'll get an absolutely brilliant reader and you'll be completely and utterly gripped. I listened to The Seven Pillars of Wisdom recently by T.E. Lawrence. And he's a very ponderous writer, Lawrence, and it was 28 hours of I'm wonderful but very insecure, and the reader had just the right voice for him, and I felt I was actually listening to T.E. Lawrence, and he made it so much less painful than it could have been otherwise. But I think one of my friends actually records books for the Talking Books Library in London, and she loves doing it, and I think the people who do the readings just do a fantastic job, especially the ones who are doing it now. So, yeah, no, it's wonderful. I am so grateful.
So back to your book. In fact, first of all, what can you actually see?
I've got about sort of 4 or 5% of normal vision. So it's very, very misty. It's like looking into a dark room, or a smoke-filled room through a keyhole. So it's very limited aperture. I've got usable central vision, so long as I have bright light, and if I need to read something, very strong glasses. But really, everything's just very misty and a very narrow field of vision, and I don't see stereoscopically anymore. There's kind of a big gap down the middle where my nose is, I guess.
You don't wear the glasses for climbing?
No, I don't. To be honest, I climb blind. There's just too much going on the rock for me to be able to focus on anything. So, yeah, no, I basically just switch that part of my brain off and rely on touch.
You were talking about climbing frozen waterfalls. I wondered if the glare would affect the climb.
When I climb, I wear sunglasses, because even on something like sandstone, if there's bright sunshine, it just hurts too much. The glare is too much. So, yeah, climbing a frozen waterfall. Anyway, you have to wear goggles if you're ice climbing. So I'd probably just wear a pair of dark goggles to just cut out all that light. It also means I have to wear a helmet at all times, which you should do climbing anyway. But I have hit my head on so many overhangs as I've come up. In fact, the BBC weren't overly happy about what I did to their GoPro camera when I was climbing the old Manafoy. So, yeah, it was tested to destruction.
And what level of communication do you have with your guide?
If I'm climbing something tricky, if I need guiding, then it's pretty constant chatter between the two of us. If I'm climbing a less extreme grade, which is kind of within my pay grade, then I don't say anything. The guide might turn around and say, look, you need to bear left a little bit, or there's a big overhang coming up above your head. But if I'm climbing anything up to about HVS, then I can do that pretty much by myself. Yeah, they will tell me to sort of keep the easiest line because I sometimes just stray off. But yeah, because it's slower, there doesn't tend to be that constant chatter unless I'm climbing something that sort of is very steep and sort of pushing me out, in which case I just want to get the hell off it as quickly as possible.
Is there a climb you know well enough that you think you could do it on your own?
Yeah, there are various routes. There are a couple of places down in Portland on Blacknor North where I think I could probably do it from memory. Part of the reason I like climbing things like sandstone and limestone, and also to an extent gritstone, is that they've got cracks in them. It's a bit like being a sort of tram following the tram lines. I can sort of guide myself up there until the crack runs out. But, and actually I think I could probably do pitches 3, 4 and 5 on the Old Man of Hoy by myself, and probably pitch 1, but I couldn't do the crux pitch by myself. It's just, there's no margin for error on the crux pitch, and I think that's probably true of an awful lot of multi-pitch climbs where you've got the difficult bit. If you can't see, you do need a hand.
What was it like standing on top of the Old Man of Hoy?
Absolutely amazing. The listeners won't be able to see the huge grin on my face, but I still get a kick out of just thinking it. It was the culmination of a 30-year dream, and it was also it was a lovely meeting of being able to stick 2 fingers up to the diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa and thinking that was the end of my climbing for good, aged 19, and also an acceptance that retinitis pigmentosa is part of me. And without it, I would probably never have climbed the Old Man of Hoy. I would have, you know, been sitting in front of some computer in some office and, you know, would have let my climbing dreams go, I suspect. So it was an exhilarating and yet a reconciling type feeling. And I'd do it all again tomorrow.
Is there anything else on the horizon, an El Capitan or an Everest? Or?
There's a third sea stack. I've climbed the Old Man of Stour as well. There's a third big sea stack, which is Ambukal, up in Sandwood Bay. That involves 2 of my other loves, mountain bike tandeming out to it, then swimming 30 metres to get to the base, and then climbing. So I tried to do that in June, but the wind and the waves kept us off. It was just too stormy. So I'm going back next year to nail that one. I'd love to get out to the Alps and do some climbing out there, maybe give the Matterhorn a go. And, yeah, my brother-in-law's just moved out to San Francisco, and he keeps saying, oh, you should come to Yosemite and give something like El Capitan a go. If there's a rock wall there waiting for me and I can get the plane out, then I will be there.
And it's very appropriate today that your talk was sponsored by Fight for Sight.
Very, very kind of them to do so. They do some amazing work as the UK's leading charity funding medical research, because, you know, that gives hope to, you know, the 2 million of us who have eye diseases in this country, and to millions of others around the world. And I'm delighted to be standing under their banner.
If someone visually impaired is listening and fancies a go at climbing, maybe not the Old Man of Hoy just yet, but where should they start?
Go to an indoor climbing wall. It doesn't matter whether it's a high wall with top ropes or a bouldering wall, because there are bouldering walls popping up all over the place now. And just take a few lessons. They're not particularly expensive. And find how your balance is. I think blind people make very good climbers because we have to try and rely on our balance so we don't trip over things, or, you know, if we do trip over things, so that we don't fall flat on our faces. And it's a very tactile sport. The barrier to me climbing was that there weren't climbing walls back in the, well, very few climbing walls back in the 1980s. And I genuinely thought that if I couldn't trust my sight, nobody would trust me to climb with me. And that's wrong. I've found All the instructors I've had over the years have been incredibly open-minded as far as my loss of sight is concerned. And there's none of that, oh, God, you climb well for a blind person. It's just, you know, you climb well. You know, this is a sport you can do. And you know, just climb higher. So, yeah, go to your local climbing wall, find a nice instructor, and just rely on your balance and your legs. We walk around on our legs all the time. They're what hold us up. Blind people have good balance, and I think it gives us a bit of an edge, to be honest.
So Wigtown back in 2015, we kept in touch after that, and about a year later, you took over the presenting job on Read On, and we're now looking back at 100 shows so far. Now, what was your first ever interview?
Ooh, it was a biggie. Believe it or not, it was Anthony Horowitz telling me why he prefers 007 to John le Carré.
Cue the old jazzy jingle.
This is Read On Air.
Anthony Horowitz is a veteran of the spy drama world. With the best-selling Alex Rider spy series already under his belt, he wasn't the first author to take on the world of 007 in his novel Trigger Mortis. Uniquely, though, he was given permission to use previously unpublished material written by Fleming himself. Horowitz used this to really inhabit the world of James Bond and to set the scene in the novel's opening chapter. Who better, then, to argue the case for Fleming in a spy versus spy showdown? Two titans of the spy genre were under scrutiny. Ian Fleming was up against John le Carré. I travelled to a, well, not so top secret location to find out why, to his mind, Ian Fleming had the edge over all other spy writers.
At the time, German rocket research was already well advanced, for although the much-hated Treaty of Versailles had placed huge restrictions on the development of weapons, space travel had been excluded. This played into the hands of the German military, who quickly realized that liquid-fueled rockets launched from fairly simple makeshift platforms could travel further and faster than any artillery weapon, delivering their payload into every major city in Europe.
I'm not actually that good at speaking in public because I get cripplingly nervous and ill, and I spend hours and hours preparing myself, and I won't be happy however well it goes or however badly it goes. So goodness knows why I'm doing it. But then
it's the curse of the writer being a perfectionist, I think.
It's a curse of the modern writer who is expected to be able to talk and to perform in front of an audience. In the old days, you could just sit quietly at home and write. Nowadays, you have to go out there and be a performer too.
Absolutely. Well, I'm very interested to know what, in a nutshell, you think makes Ian Fleming a greater writer than John le Carré.
Well, we're speaking just before the debate, and of course anything I say to you is deeply confidential, as I don't want to give away my strategy later on. But for me, I think that the nub of my argument is this, is that we live in a slightly puritanical society in which we frown upon books that simply give you pleasure, which are fun, which are entertaining, which don't in any way challenge or even bore you. And that, I think, is what will persuade people perhaps not to vote for Fleming, because he is too enjoyable. But actually, where his greatness lies is that he has managed to transcend fiction and transcend books and literature. I can only think of two other writers who have done it. One is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the other is J.K. Rowling, who somehow enter the bloodstream, become part of the DNA, who become representative of the times in which they live, and enter the sort of the national consciousness. And as much as one may admire a writer like Le Carré, which incidentally I do, I don't think he has done that. And I think therein lies Fleming's greatness.
And yes, I agree. And actually, James Bond is an international character, whereas arguably George Smiley is quite personal to the United Kingdom.
I don't know what the foreign sales are for both of them. Maybe I should have found out. Actually, if you've got inside track, you should give me the pages now and I'll slip them into my talk. But that is absolutely true. I mean, you know, it is also part of my job to differentiate the books from the films. I mean, a startling fact is that apparently one third of the planet, one in three people, have seen a James Bond film. But how many people have actually read the books, and to what extent can you claim greatness for Fleming looking at the films? This, I think, is one of the interesting areas of the debate, the difference between the books and the films. It's something I will be talking about.
Yes, I don't know if it's particularly pertinent, but I do remember wandering around a flea market in Toulouse and seeing a complete collection of James Bond books from the 1960s in French, which actually did my A-level French a remarkable amount of good. But clearly he'd sold fairly well in France. They'd been well dog-eared.
Well, I mean, Fleming has sold about 100 million copies around the world, 40 million of those in his lifetime. That's out of just 12 books and two collections of short stories. For what it's worth, Le Carré, with 23 novels to his name, has sold around about 75 million copies, which is, you know, not bad, but it's not quite there.
No, absolutely. I'm interested, though, because I know that you've said that Alex Rider has a bit of James Bond in him. I'd argue that Christopher Foyle has quite a lot of George Smiley in him. Would you have felt as easy arguing the Le Carré corner had it been handed to you rather than the Ian Fleming corner?
Well, I've made a point in my talk today not to disparage Le Carré in any way at all, because I think that's not a pleasant thing to do in a debate. It's not gentlemanly. But I will be honest with you and say, between us, that I have never really been a great Le Carré fan. I love The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, The Honourable Schoolboy, and one or two others. Little Drummer Girl, I remember liking a lot. But actually, I find a lot of his later work quite trying and difficult to enjoy. So I'm not sure I could have actually taken Le Carré's side in this debate. You know, Bond has been a huge influence on me. As you rightly said, my own Alex Rider stories came straight out of them. Dr. No, the Bond girl in it, incidentally not words that Fleming himself would have ever have used, is called Honey Child Rider, and I've always thought of her as the spiritual mother of Alex. And, you know, that's the other thing about this, which is that it's possible, and indeed it's sensible, to admire Le Carré. And I think millions of people have enjoyed his book, but I doubt that very many people have had their lives changed by them. Whereas I would say that probably quite a few people, certainly of my age, did have their life changed by Fleming. And when the books came out in 1952, the very first one, you know, this was something really astonishing and new and a beacon to a future world. You know, in a funny way, he cut the path that Le Carré then followed.
So that's your first ever interview on Read On, or as it was called at the time, Read On Air. You and Anthony Horowitz apparently in an echoey toilet somewhere.
Oh, actually, it was a large hall in central Westminster where he was giving a talk. He was arguing that Ian Fleming was a better author than John Le Carré. He lost, unfortunately, but you know.
Now, it's been quite the 100 shows. We've had people like Neil Gaiman, we've had Bill Bryson, and indeed Anthony Horowitz. But it's not just the big names that we get on Read On.
No, we're lucky enough to know some people with their ears very close to the ground. So we get to hear of tomorrow's bestsellers before they've even hit the shelves. Always think back to the first time I heard about Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, about a week before it was published.
Thanks to the partnership between publisher HarperCollins and RNIB, available now at the same time as the print and commercial audio versions, is the talking book of Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. It's read by Catherine McCarran.
When people ask me what I do, taxi drivers, dental hygienists, I tell them I work in an office. In almost 9 years, no one's ever asked what kind of office or what sort of job I do there. I can't decide whether that's because I fit perfectly with their idea of what an office worker looks like, or whether people hear the phrase work in an office and automatically fill in the blanks themselves. Lady doing photocopying, man tapping at a keyboard. I'm not complaining. I'm delighted that I don't have to get into the fascinating intricacies of accounts receivable with them.
Gail Honeyman joined me in the RNIB Connect radio studios and told me about the book.
The book is the story of Eleanor Oliphant. She's quite an unusual young woman. She's 30 years old. She lives and works in Glasgow. She leads a very regimented life. She leads a very solitary life. she's someone who's learned how to survive, but maybe not how to live, if that makes sense. She has a chance encounter in the street with an old man who has an accident. She happens to be with a colleague, again by chance. And this one incident sets off a whole series of revelations which helps Eleanor develop and come to terms with things that have happened in her life, and we as readers find out why she is the way she is.
Mr. Gibbons is calling an ambulance, I said. So don't worry, you won't be lying here in the middle of the street for long. There's no need to be anxious. Medical care is completely free of charge in this country, and the standard is generally considered to be among the best in the world. You're a fortunate man. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to fall and bump your head in, say, the new state of South Sudan, given its current political and economic situation. But here in Glasgow, well, you've struck it lucky, if you'll pardon the pun. Raymond hung up and scuttled over. How's he doing, Eleanor? He said. Has he come round yet? No, I said, but I've been talking to him like you asked. Raymond took the man's other hand. Good old soul, he said. I nodded.
It's a slow drip. You're fed information. I remember feeling frustrated at one point that I wanted to read the social worker's report. So was that a very deliberate thing?
I wanted to try and keep the readers engaged. So I know that myself. It's when I'm reading other people's work, it's great when you feel, oh, I just have to keep reading on because I'm intrigued. There's something here that I'm not being told and I want to find out what it is. So I was trying my best to create that sort of set of circumstances in my book. Yeah, I hope it worked.
So certainly the first half of the book, it's a book about loneliness.
Yeah, I had read a newspaper article about loneliness a few years back, and one of the people they interviewed was a young woman who was in her late 20s, and she'd said she had a flat and a professional job and so on, but she said if she didn't make a special effort after she left work on Friday night, she sometimes the whole weekend would go by and she wouldn't speak to another human being until Monday morning. And I was a bit taken aback by that, because usually when we hear about loneliness, when it's discussed in the media, it's often in the context of older people, which is a huge issue, obviously. But I was intrigued that you don't usually hear about it with younger people, people in their 20s, early 30s. So I started to think about how someone could find themselves in that set of circumstances. And actually, when I thought about it, it wasn't at all difficult to think how that could come about. And so I wanted to try and show, I hope I've shown in the book, as Eleanor opens herself up to new experiences and to meeting new people, she starts to make connections, and things change so much for her because of that.
Let's slightly dance around spoiler material without giving anything away. I'm very aware we don't want to give anything away, but let's talk about mental health and the matter-of-fact way she reports on things with a sort of lack of emotion. It reminds me of other books that have featured characters who are maybe autistic or have Asperger's. Is there anything like that involved with Eleanor?
Personally, I didn't write her as a character with either of those conditions, but she does. I can see that there are some traits that you might think she shares with those, but no, I think it's more she's a survivor of some very challenging things without wanting to give away too much in the plot, and I think those have shaped her as an adult, and it's difficult to say without giving away the end. I think there's always the possibility of change.
The lovely Gail Honeyman there talking about Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine, which has since won a slew of awards. And please note, like many of the interviews in today's show, that one was cut short for time. You can hear the whole interview on our Audioboom page. Just go to audioboom.com and search for R&IB Talking Books. You're listening to a special 100th edition of Read on R&IB Connect Radio with myself, Robert Kirkwood, and Red Sail. Now, I'm based in Glasgow. Red, you're down there in London. We're very rarely in the same place at the same time, unless we get a chance to go to a book festival. But we're lucky that the R&IB Connect Radio studio in Camden in London is the same building as the R&IB Talking Book Studios. So, Red, you get to meet a lot of the people who make our books.
Which is one of the best aspects of the job for me, you know, the voices that I've become so familiar with over the years who read the books that are so important to me. actually gather in the kitchen around the coffee machine, and I get to meet them and talk to them, and sometimes I drag them into my studio.
And one such person was the son of Goon Harry Secombe, Andy Secombe.
And I asked him about his return to showbiz.
I got a call from an old mate of mine, an old radio producer called Dirk Maggs, who said, do you want to come and work for me? I'm doing a stage show. I'm doing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, live, on stage, with a band and lights and everything. And I said yes, as you would, given an offer like that. And it was great fun. And I found myself back in the entertainment world and thought, do you know, I've really missed all this. I've really, really missed all this. And so I started to get myself back. I got myself an agent again. And I started doing more and more voice work. And as I sort of put myself about, I discovered RNIB talking books. And people had told me what fun it was to work here. And also that it's very good experience, apart from anything else. And I thought, well, I'll try and see if I'm any good, because it's not something that everyone can do. People told me that many, many times, and I said, well, I'll give it a go. Even some very, very good actors can't, for some reason, satisfactorily read a book. But I sort of took to it and thought, this is great fun. And, yeah, I've done, I don't know how many books I've done now, quite a few for RNIB, and I really, really love it.
And you've done some great titles. I've listened to many of them, and then as I went down the list, I noticed that you've done The Saga of Eric the Viking.
Oh, yes, yes.
Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them by J.K. Rowling.
Yes, 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 yes.
And recently, actually, I was interviewing Andrew Beasley, who wrote The Ben Kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
And they're great fun books, aren't they?
They are. They're wonderfully, wonderful fun books. Well, they're quite tricky because lots of characters, lots and lots and lots of characters. And there are underground people and overground people. And it's sort of trying to differentiate between not only the different gangs, but the members in each gangs. You know, you make them a bit gruff, or do you make them a bit light, or you know, whatever you do. The Viking one was quite interesting because I think I made them all Scottish, and I had about sort of 15 different types of Scottish accent, which was got a bit confusing for everybody, me included.
Yeah, I suppose you couldn't really make them Welsh, could you?
Not really, no. A Welsh Viking wouldn't really work, I don't think.
Could start a whole new genre.
Yeah, confuse a lot of people, I think.
And you've also done some fairly edgy thrillers as well. I noticed that you've done the Oscar de Muriel Mexican writer.
Yeah, the Strings of Murder. It's not that's a Scottish one. The Strings of Murder. With Nine Niels McGree. They were great fun. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed those.
Do you have a favourite book that you've narrated?
I suppose it would have been the first Nine Niels one, because it wasn't like anything I'd done before, and it's written slightly tongue in cheek. There are gags in it, and it gives you an opportunity as an actor to go slightly over the top, which I generally tend to do anyway. So it kind of suited my style, and I just had an absolute ball with it. You know, when you sort of connect with something on the page, I think it comes across. I really, really enjoyed that.
That's an interview that always has me giggling. I remember the brilliant voices that he did during that interview, which you can hear in the whole interview on the Audio Boom page. Just go to the front page of RNIB Connect Radio and find the link there.
And staying in the realm of the Goons, Read On doesn't just interview authors and narrators. We sometimes go behind the scenes to see how talking books are made. Now, some talking books that I've loved ever since I was old enough to listen to them are Spike Milligan's War Diaries. And through a bit of research, I managed to find Robert Nicol, a man who worked as a producer or an editor on every single one of those books. And not only that, he gave me some audio to play that had never been heard in public before.
I'm first sitting, said Molloy, referring to his seating card. Good, I said. I was second sitting. Oh, why don't you change to first, he said. No. I'll change it to second, I said. So while I waited, he did.
Hang on a minute. Doesn't he say, no, wait, I'll change?
I'm first sitting, said Molloy. Yeah.
Excuse me for being...
I'm trying to avoid sitting with him.
Yeah, I see, sorry. Excuse me for being dense.
Where shall I go from?
Could you go from I'm first sitting?
I got a nice cabin, he said. I waited for him to sell it. So sorry. Do you know if I wait there?
It's all right.
In the outtakes that we have, there are female voices in there as well.
Yes, I can tell you what happens is the first recording I think we did with Spike was Adolf Hitler, and I had a director called John Green. In the studio, if I paint a picture for you, you have the actor voiceover artist, Spike Milligan, one side, and on the other side, I'm the sound engineer who presses start on the record and also keeps my ear on the sound. And then I have a director. Now, the director's job is to have read the book to give the to help the artist give a proper interpretation on the read. Because sometimes, you know, if you might use the wrong voice or you might need to slow down the read to give more feel to a particular part. And the director's job is to be that person, a bit like a conductor, you know, conducting an orchestra. The director conducts the voice artist. And I found very early on that if I put a woman director with Spike, my life was much easier. He responded so much better to being told what to do by a female than a male. So the voice you hear in the outtakes is a lady called Anne Rosenfeld. And she became like my babysitter to Spike. She looked after him and kept him happy. Spike responded much better to the female touch.
That's part of a much longer feature I did about Spike Milligan that's available, as with all of our interviews, on our Audio Boom page. It was part of a feature where I reviewed Spike Milligan's War Diaries, and book reviews themselves make up a big part of Read On. And not just from Red and myself, some listeners send in reviews of their own.
But seriously, the book is great, so any Poirot fans I'm sure will love it. It's the third book Sophie Hannah has written, but each book is a standalone, so you can take them in any order, really. And it was my favourite of hers, so I'm really looking forward to the next book, which I believe will be out next year.
How dare you? How dare you send me such a letter?
Madame, pardon me, but I do not believe we know one another.
Don't act the part of the innocent with me.
N.B. Dixon reviewing Sophie Hannah's The Mystery of Three Quarters. And if you'd like to send in a review, you can always get in touch with us by emailing the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, celebrating 100 shows. And next up, here's our favourite of Red's.
Some of the most exciting new titles that we get to talk about are from the young adult fiction shelves, and this was one that really caught my imagination. If you haven't already heard of her, Jessica Townsend is a name to remember. Her debut novel, Nevermore, The Trials of Morrigan Crow, is the first in a magical series that's being hailed as the new Harry Potter. No fewer than 8 major publishing houses were vying for the English language rights to Nevermore at last year's Frankfurt Book Fair. And then 20th Century Fox snapped up the film rights. The book's feisty hero, Morrigan Crow, is a cursed child, battling unseen enemies to fulfill a noble quest beyond her understanding. Like J.K. Rowling, Jessica Townsend creates an enchanted and enchanting world that's full of whimsical inventions, colourful characters, and gripping adventure. She's already attracted legions of fans and embarked on a worldwide publicity tour, but she took time off to join me in the studio. Jess Townsend, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, tell us a little bit more about the world of Nevermore.
Nevermore is a an imaginary place. It's a place made up. It's sort of inspired by London, inspired a lot by my time in London. And the book Nevermore is about a little girl called Morrigan Crow, who is cursed. So she's born on the wrong day, the unluckiest day, a day called Eventide. And because of this day that she's born, she gets blamed for everything that goes wrong in her world. So there's a little boy who loses a spelling competition and she gets the blame, and someone has a heart attack and she gets the blame, and a school burns down and she gets the blame for that too. So Nevermore, the other side of this curse is that Morrigan also knows when she's going to die. So she's supposed to die on her next birthday, but instead she gets rescued and sort of spirited away into this secret magical city called Nevermore. And she's been invited to stay with this strange person in a magical hotel and compete against hundreds of other children to join the Wonder Society. And she has to have a talent. So all of these hundreds of kids, they all have some kind of talent or a knack for something that is supposed to get them into the Wonder Society. But the catch is that Morrigan doesn't have one, and she needs to get into the society if she's going to be allowed to stay.
And the wonderful, rather dandyish figure who rescues her is called Jupiter North, who reminded me of all those wonderful characters like Bertie Wooster or so on and so forth. But he's just like Bertie Wooster. He, underneath, he's actually a lot smarter than the clothing might make him appear.
Right. I think he comes, and he probably likes coming across as quite silly and not a particularly good adult. I think he is sort of a composite of, you know, all of those characters like Bertie Wooster that I sort of grew up, you know, I grew up watching British television and reading British books, so he's very much influenced by that. But yeah, he is a terrible adult, but in some ways he has his moments. He's quite wise and sort of funny.
And it's a wonderfully fun story. I mean, you clearly have really enjoyed writing it and soaked up, well, I guess, everything you've ever read or experienced. It was about 10 years in the making.
Yeah, it took quite a long time. And I mean, it's that sort of, you know, that side of, you know, really enjoying what I was writing and having fun. Honestly, that's the only reason that I think I finished it, because I'm such a procrastinator, like probably every other writer in the world. And, you know, this is the first book that I've written. It's the first kind of whole story that I've completed, and it did take a long time. But, you know, it's a result of writing the book that I just desperately wanted to read, and every kind of shiny new idea that I had that could have gone on and been a story in its own right, I just sort of thought, well, I'll just put it in Nevermore. It became a bit of a kitchen sink novel in that way.
And I read somewhere that actually Nevermore spun out from another story that you were writing beforehand.
Right. So way, way, way back in the beginning, I started, I'm not even sure if I started sort of writing much of it. I might have written a few pages, but I was plotting a story about a little girl who went to live with her eccentric aunt Morrigan. And her aunt Morrigan was this brave woman who was quite sharp and quite funny and interesting and eccentric. And I started, as I was writing that story, I started realizing that the protagonist, this little girl, was quite boring. And her aunt was the far more interesting. Her aunt and her aunt's best friend, Hawthorne, were the far more interesting people. And I just sort of dialed that back and started thinking about, well, what was she like when she was a little girl? Where did she come from? What happened to her in her childhood that made her so brave and so funny and interesting?
You started writing this, I think I read, when you just finished high school.
Mm.
And whilst you were working at Australia Zoo, were there squeezy crocodiles?
Unlikely but true, yes. Yeah, so that was my first job straight out of high school. You can clearly hear that I talk funny. I am Australian. I live on the from the Sunshine Coast, which is about 20 minutes from Steve Owen's zoo. And it was my first job out of high school. I was working in a shop folding T-shirts, selling squeezy crocodiles. And I ended up doing a bunch of other different jobs there. I spent about 5 years there. It's the sort of place where if you kind of just muck in and prove that you can, that you're willing to try and willing to work hard, then they'll kind of let you do anything. So weirdly, at the end of that time, I was editing a children's wildlife magazine, which was quite fun.
The lovely Jessica Townsend, and as with many of the interviews in today's show, that one was cut a wee bit short. You can find the whole interview on our Audioboom page. Just head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB Talking Books. Now, I think we've got time left in the show for one more interview from the past 100 episodes of Read On and Read. I think I can guess what you're going to choose.
Yes, I'm going to go for the pinnacle of my past 2 years of presenting this programme. A man who not only inspired me to climb, but also to write about climbing. It's Sir Chris Bonington. In a career spanning 7 decades to date, he became the first Briton to climb the north face of the Eiger, summited Everest aged 50, led numerous expeditions to seemingly impregnable peaks, and is still climbing aged 83. He's written extensively about his adventures in books such as Annapurna South Face and Everest the Hard Way. He records the challenges of mounting expeditions to achieve the impossible. And in autobiographical works such as I Chose to Climb, he explores the personal side of the path that he has chosen, including its many tragedies. Now he's brought those twin lines together in his new book, Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge. Keen to find out more, I caught up with him at the Petworth Festival. But first, a clip from the audiobook.
How far are our personalities and the course of our lives shaped by the genes we inherit, and how far by the environment in which we are brought up? I rather think it's a combination of the two. But with our genetic makeup, having a very strong influence and those traits becoming visible from a young age. Looking back at my immediate ancestors, quite a few of them were undoubtedly adventurous in a variety of ways. They weren't great explorers or sportspeople, but they carved out a distinct life of their own. On my mother's side, my grandmother, whom I knew as Nan, and who played a major part in my early upbringing, was brought up a Catholic, the 10th child of a family of 12. Her father, Timothy Doran, was born in 1814 in Enniscorthy, County Wexford, went to Sydney as a young man, attracted by stories of fortunes to be made from the gold rush that started around that time. Until the gold rush, the majority of migrants had been convicts. For Timothy, it was a step into the unknown, starting with the horrendous 4-month voyage in a cramped sailing ship around the Cape of Good Hope and across the empty southern Indian Ocean, battened down in the hold for days on end, drinking brackish water and eating weevil-infested food. He spent 20 years in Australia, but didn't talk about it. Only scraps of family legend persisted. He spent most of his time in Sydney, but ventured out to the lawless goldfields, where if he saw a shadow fall across his tent, he shot first, and only then went out to investigate.
Gordon Griffin reading the audible version of Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge, by my guest, Sir Chris Bonington.
One thing I was really struck by in Ascent is just how much climbing is a matter of relationships, whether that's on the mountainside at home or with your sponsors.
Well, totally. I mean, the key relationships are the friendships you make in the mountains and with the people you climb, either in this country or in the Himalayas. But also, yes, your sponsors and, of course, the link at home and the support you get from home.
And the group of climbers that you were climbing with in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they really were pushing the envelope of what was possible at the time. Do you think we will ever see the like of that kind of pioneering climbing again?
I think my generation was incredibly lucky coming into adulthood immediately after the Second World War, when so much was still to be done. I mean, in fact, no 8,000 metre peaks have been climbed until, of course, Maurice Herzog reached the top of Annapurna. And so that there are a lot of big, obvious, exciting challenges to make. I think the problem that the modern climber has is that there are less obvious kind of challenges. They're climbing at an incredible high degree, but the general public and the media can't really get their heads around it.
And actually, the things, the achievements that reach the public attention may not necessarily be the most impressive extreme climbs that are being done at the moment.
Well, yes, so, I mean, one of the problems is that firstly, they can't really get Everest out of their minds. And Everest is, you know, it's just endless stories of crowds going up the mountains and unfortunate disasters, while the real climbers are quietly getting on with doing a lot of very, very hard climbs.
As you say in the book, when you reached the summit of Everest in 1985, you had it pretty much to yourself. How do you feel about the hundreds of people going up in a line to the summit of Everest nowadays?
Well, thank God I managed to get up it before they allowed that to happen. I think it was inevitable, and I don't really begrudge it, because each one of those people, who a lot of them are comparatively inexperienced, but have forked out between $25,000 and $60,000 for the privilege of getting to the top of the mountain. But it is a huge experience in their lives. And what do you do? Do you ration it, in which case less people are going to be able to do it, or maybe only the very rich can do it? Or do you let it happen as it is? Where, yeah, a lot of people find that pleasure and excitement. And as far as people like myself go, if you want to have the mountains yourselves, there's still thousands of unclimbed peaks in the Himalayas.
I know reaching the summit of Everest was a major landmark for you. I wonder, was that your favourite climb? Do you have a favourite achievement?
No, I think reaching the summit of Everest was like an irritant. And I really wanted to get there. And I didn't realise just how important it was until I did get there. And then it was kind of, thank God I've got that out of the way. And after 85 and since then, I've had a whole series of exploratory expeditions, some of them quite zany expeditions, and all of them great fun.
And, of course, one of the most recent was climbing the Old Man of Hoy, aged 80. What led you to do that?
Well, it was primarily a great friend of mine, Leo Holding's idea. Leo Holding, he's one of our athletes. I'm chairman of Berghaus, which does outdoors clothing. And Leo said, well, look, why don't you come and do the Old Man of Hoy when you're 80? I'm the youngest person to have done it. He was 11 when he was taken up by his dad. And it meant a hell of a lot to me. It was a struggle to get up, but it was also for me a kind of almost a catharsis that helped me after the loss of my wife.
And of course, you raised funds and awareness about motor neurone disease, which was clearly very important to you in that process too.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, it's a horrible disease, and nobody, so little's known about it. It's incurable. And so the more funds one can actually raise to try to find a cure for motor neurone disease is hugely worthwhile.
Your account of climbing the Old Man of Hoy in I Chose to Climb stuck with me and is why I climbed it myself. And so I Chose to Climb has long been one of my favourite books. Do you have a favourite climbing book?
I would say actually The White Spider was an inspiration to me. Even earlier than that, W.H. Murray's Mountaineering in Scotland. And that was when I read that in the early 1950s. Really, the Alps and the Eiger and Everest and everything else was beyond my reach. But the wilds of Scotland were within my reach. And that really inspired me.
And finally, would you prefer to be on rock or on ice?
I love both. They're different. I think for sheer sensual pleasure, though, when you're climbing at your peak, there's nothing like really good rock climbing when you're pushing the limits.
I couldn't agree more. So, Chris Bonington, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On Air.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
The White Spider. The Story of the North Face of the Eiger by Heinrich Harrer. The spider on the Eiger's face is white. Its body consists of ice and eternal snow. Its legs and its predatory arms, all hundreds of feet long, are white too. From that perpetual, fearfully steep field of frozen snow, nothing but ice emerges to fill gullies, cracks and crevices. Up and down, to left, to right, in every direction, at every angle of steepness. And there the spider waits. Every climber who picks his way up the north face of the Eiger has to cross it. There is no way round it. And even those who move best and most swiftly up the face have met their toughest ordeal on the Spider. Someone once compared the whole face to a gigantic spider's web, catching the spider's victims and feeding them to her. This comparison is unfounded, exaggerated, and merely a cheap way of making the flesh creep. Neither the savage wall nor the lovely mountain have deserved this slur. Nor have the climbers, for climbers are not flies and insects stumbling blindly to their fate, but men of vision and courage. All the same, the white spider seems to me to be a good symbol for the north face. The climber has to face its perils on the final third of the wall, when he's tired from many hours and days of exhausting climbing and weakened by chilly bivouacs. But there is no rest to be had there, no matter how tired you are. He who wishes to survive the spate of avalanches which sweep the spider must realize that there is no escape from this dangerously steep obstacle. He must know how to blend his strength with patience and reflection. Above the spider begin the overhanging iced-up exit cracks. That is where sheer strength tells. But here, the man who abandons patience and good sense for fear-induced haste will surely finish up like the fly, which struggles so long in the spider's web that it is caught through sheer exhaustion.
A clip from The White Spider, the story of the north face of the Eiger, written by Heinrich Hara and narrated by Philip Bretherton, which is available as TB18839. And they say you should never meet your heroes. Several of Chris Bonington's books are available from the RNIB library in a variety of accessible formats, including I Chose to Climb, which is TB5877, and Annapurna South Face, which is TB1646. Let's hope Ascent joins them there soon. Well, that's about it for our retrospective on our past 100 shows.
And thanks to everyone who's been in touch and all the authors, narrators and people behind the scenes who've been involved.
Some of the interviews you've just heard were cut a little bit short so that we could fit more of them into the show. But if you want to hear the full versions or any of our past shows, you can do so by going to our Audio Boom page.
There's a link on the front page of the website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB Talking Books.
You can find us both on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
We'll be back to business as usual this time next week, but in the meantime, don't forget to read on. Now, go and get some Lemsip, Robert.
I'm going.